You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Over 7 million different animals inhabit our planet.
K-puffin population is predicted to nosedive by over 90% in the next 30 years if we don't take severe action.
What can they teach us?
One's sending a lot of the cool puffin beak stuff, and so...
Well, yeah. So it does, under UV light, it glows, and the scientists don't know why. It could be because... They can probably see it better.
Many species are in crisis and need your help. Join the movement at allcreaturespod.com.
Welcome to All Creatures Podcast. This is Chris.
And I'm Angie.
And this is the sea parrot or clowns of the sea?
Clowns of the sea. Puffins.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
Just so fun. A beautiful bird. Somewhat silly looking bird, a migratory bird, just a beautiful bird. And The puffins are a lot of fun. I've been lucky enough to see them at Zoo Atlanta and watch them just do their thing and just be enamored by their behavior and just their look, right? They're just a beautiful bird. But I can see why they're called the clown of the sea.
No, they are. They are. I mean, and what I love about puffins is it relates to a story that I've been talking a lot about last 15 years when I talk conservation, and that's about the great auk, which I'm finally going to be able to talk to about today, because this is like the penguins of the north. You know, there aren't any penguins north of the equator. The closest we know are the ones near the Galapagos, but most penguins are down my way in the southern hemisphere, South Pacific, South Atlantic, and South Indian Oceans. Where puffins, you know, the Atlantic puffin is the most iconic one, but then there's a couple just over on the other side in the North Pacific.
Oh, yeah, Chris. I didn't realize how migratory puffins were. And so I just did some digging. Of course, we'll dive into it when we get into the behavior, but they're mostly European, right? And so, especially we're going to talk a lot today about the Atlantic puffin, which the IUCN recognizes as vulnerable, and they need our help big time to protect their numbers. The UK, so a shout out to your beautiful wife, Pip. The UK puffin population is predicted to nosedive by over 90% in the next 30 years if we don't take severe action on trying to help them out in the wild and their breeding grounds and things like that. So they have a lot of threats, and it was very eye-opening for me. I wasn't fully aware of some of the crisis they were under and their migratory nature of, especially the Atlantic puffin, of going from Europe across the pond, as we call it, to North America and back all in 1 year. It just actually reminded me of you and Pip when you first started dating and you had to do some... You both had to travel back and forth and hop over the pond here and there.
Oh, I know. And I just wish I was as big of a bird nerd as I am now to go and see the puffins in Wales because I know they were there. And I remember Pip saying, oh, we should go to Puffin Island. And I was like, oh, that might be cool, but I want to go look at this castle over here or something. And
right. Just like,
now I would be like, oh, this bird was spotted in Northeast Scotland. Let's go. It's only 6 hours away.
You know, exactly. Like, exactly. No. Yeah, and well, that's the thing too, with their numbers plummeting, you know, in Europe. I mean, the good news is there's still over a million puffins in the UK alone, but that just has a big potential to decline if we don't spend more time trying to protect them in their breeding areas. But so it's been a fun couple weeks actually. They've been studying puffins since we haven't recorded in a few weeks, and hopefully you'll fall in love with a puffin if you haven't already.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're just beautiful birds.
And before we dive into all the fun facts and behavior about puffins, I want to give a quick shout out to Emily. I just spent actually about an hour with her and her Girl Scout troop from Virginia, having a Zoom chat talking all about animals and science and my career and podcasting and how I got from point A to point B, which obviously Chris is a big part of that story, and just answering their questions about science and career. And it was really inspiring. So thank you to Emily for reaching out, and it was fun chatting with y'all.
Yeah, and if you want to talk to me and Angie, I mean, just allcreaturespod@gmail.com. I've done a couple of talks to veterinary groups back in the States, around the world. We'd love to talk to students and just inspire them. And Angie's just an inspiration, you know, watching her through graduate school, and she was pregnant twice, and you battled through and got your PhD, which is incredible.
I think when I talk to students, and I tell them my whole nonlinear story, I think they're like, okay, if she can do it, I can do it too. I'm kind of like the clown of not of the sea, but of like graduate school and discombobulation of not exactly knowing what I wanted. A lot of times it was knowing what I didn't want. Like after I shadowed a veterinarian for a while in high school and college, I realized, okay, no, I don't want to be a veterinarian. That's not for me. So, and then it was just a lot of bobbling around and getting a lot of hard work, a little bit of luck. And going from
and
there.
Timing. So, and timing. You know, it's timing.
Exactly.
You know, it's,
exactly. Yeah. And friendships and partnerships, obviously. Yeah. We were so lucky to find each other for that. So, but yeah, I think people are like, oh, okay, like she's not perfect. That's cool.
No, it's not that. It's okay. Okay. You're one of the most hardworking students I've ever had. And that's
I have a lot of grit. Yeah. Not the best grit. No, well, like I was sharing with him, not the best GRE test scores, but Chris believed in me. He knew if I was a zookeeper, I'd be a hard worker.
You were. So. You were extremely hard worker, and you were the best. That's not to take away all the other grad students if you guys ever hear this. But yeah, Angie was just amazing, and you changed my life. And here we are talking about puffins today. Describing the three species. They are so beautiful. I need to see them.
I need to
get north of the equator and see these birds. They are so beautiful.
They are. I definitely want to put Iceland on the bucket list for many, many reasons, but this is a big new push with the puffins. But yeah, in general, the puffin, and so this is, Chris will talk a lot about the three different species and where they're from, but in general, the puffin is a short and stocky bird with their build. They have very large beaks. I think that's where they get the clown nature. And the beaks are brightly colored, especially during the breeding season. They're a bright orangey, reddish color. And we'll talk about that too when we get to breeding. In general, their plumage or their color is black and or black and whitish gray plumage over most all of their backs and towards their beak. And then around their eyes, almost similar to, I feel like a penguin, they have white plumage. So they have really white feathery eyes that stand out. And then they have a white underside. So they have that counter shading going on where the black on top, more or less, and then white on the bottom. And then just bright orange beak and bright orange red feet. And then the bill does have some really kind of cool stripes on it, if you will, for lack of better terms, that we'll talk about when we get to feeding, because it's very highly adapted beak that serrates and can hold a ton of fish. So it looks pretty and cool and kind of clown-like, but it actually plays a pretty big role as far as when they're fishing. And then other than that, they do have their wings are a little bit shorter. They're adapted for flying and for swimming with basically a flying technique underwater. And we'll talk more about that. But just a fun looking bird. So if you're not familiar with the puffin, pull over the car and then and take a nice Google search for them or come look at our show notes. We'll have plenty of pictures of puffins on there.
Oh, they're beautiful. I mean, the Atlantic, and then you have the tufted puffin and then the horned puffin. And we'll talk about the differences a little bit. Not the biggest birds, but not tiny. I mean, not songbird size, but the Atlantic puffin is 13 inches long, body length, wingspan 21 inches. So that's 30 centimeter body length with a 50 centimeter wingspan, you know, weigh 13 ounces. All birds are light. The tufted puffin is a little bit bigger, a couple inches bigger in body length and 25 inch wingspan. So a medium sized bird when you look at them, but wow, the horned puffin and the tufted puffin, oh, they're just beautiful. Like Angie said, the Atlantic puffin, I pulled this from eBird because I again, always push eBird and Merlin Bird ID. I just saw red-footed boobies. I remember sending pictures to Angie when I was off Australia, and I was like, you oh, did. My goodness, so cool. Oh, they're flying right next to me. It was so cool. It was so cool seeing them, and I can only imagine people seeing these birds off the Atlantic Ocean. So they go from parts of the Mediterranean around Spain, so southern Europe, up into the UK. They've had sightings all the way around Norway, Finland, and then obviously up north in the Arctic regions, then around Greenland and Iceland, then down the United States. Angie, just a couple weeks ago, in the USA Today website published, Florida bird rescuers shocked by rare visitors, puffins. So there is puffins. Yes, right off your coast, right off Daytona Beach.
What are they doing there?
They said there was a big storm that cooked up some colder water and pushed them south. Now, yeah, so four puffins have been seen total. Two were pretty emaciated because they're way outside their normal range and where they hunt and fish. But the other two were fine. And you sometimes see that. So Jesse always tells me with birding, whenever there's big storms off the coast of New Zealand, it pushes sometimes some of our pelagic birds inland. And we get some rare sightings of birds that normally you don't see here. So Florida, just a couple weeks ago, there was puffins. Man,
I missed it. Yeah.
I know. We just had actually in New Zealand, a Delhi penguin. They're Antarctic. They don't come this far north. It's been like 40 years since they've seen one, and there was one that washed up on shore, near Wellington. Okay, horned puffin off California, I wish I could see one, all the way up the West Coast, all the way up into British Columbia, all around Alaska. That's where most of the sightings are, all the way up there. And then it goes over to parts of Russia and then down to Japan. There's some sightings there. So that's the horned, and then tufted, same thing, but more sightings off California.
Oh, wow.
I would love to see them. I would love to see them. But as you're going to come to find out, they actually live most of the year at sea. So
Right.
Yeah. But the tufted, again, similar from Japan all the way over to Alaska, down the west coast of the United States and Canada. These are incredible, gorgeous birds. Important for our ecosystem. I mean, they fill that niche.
Oh,
the smaller fish. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, so they do prey on a variety of both aquatic and terrestrial animals. And from the aquatic point of view, a lot of fish, invertebrates, mollusks, crustaceans. So they're just that, you know, they're that middle of the road predator. So they eat a lot of things and probably a lot of things eat them. And I think from an ecosystem role, the puffins act as bioaccumulators of marine pollution, right? So when they eat a lot of fish, they can potentially have a lot of toxins and pollutants in their system. And then, unfortunately, if they're eaten, then it just goes up the ladder and bioaccumulates. So from that point of view, there's something we want to keep our eye on as far as what a healthy oceans look like and what healthy prey in that area and the ecosystem in that area, what's happening there for when they're migrating and they're spending large amounts of time out at sea and not landing at all. And then of course, similarly, when they are nesting and they are on land. So yeah, I think that they're an interesting indicator species of how our ocean and their health is doing. Cause if they're unhealthy, they're right there in the middle and they're telling us what's going on beneath the ocean.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And especially with the Atlantic puffin, you know, being on the endangered list now with being vulnerable.
Correct.
So heading, if everything continues, what that means is if everything continues the way it's going, they will go extinct. Right. That's when they make the list. You know, it's from vulnerable to extinct in the wild. That means that species is in dire straits. Mm-hmm.
And then from a positive point of view, or a little bit when it's not about the money, it's about the money, like my late father used to always say. As Chris mentioned, I mean, I heard him like, I would die to see this. I would die to see that. Mm-hmm. Well, Chris is not alone. Today, the Atlantic puffin alone contributes big time to ecotourism for people that come, for instance, to Maine to see these colorful birds in the late summer. They have estimates in the billions of dollars for all of their ecotourism for nature and different species and parks and things like that. But people like to see the puffins, and so they alone bring in, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, just for people that, you know, want to be part of the, you know, of the puffins. So that those tourism dollars alone are just very, very beneficial to the economies of where these birds like to come and hang out and nest. So I'd be curious. I didn't find any data on Iceland, which of course they have a huge nesting colony of the Atlantic puffins over there. Mm-hmm. So I'd be curious to see how much birding revenue they make there.
Oh yeah, I mean, I'd like you said, on the bucket list, one of the top five places, and then up to Alaska too. Like, oh, the wildlife up there would just be incredible. But I next time I go to the UK, I'm gonna go see. It depends on when we go. Hopefully, we can go in summer and you know, go see family there and
see.
Go
Pip's out. Always right. She was right the first time when she was like, "Let's go."
I know. Mm-hmm. Screw the castles. I'm going to see puffins.
I mean, exactly. Well, the castles will be there forever, Chris. The
yes.
It depends on how we play their cards.
Touche. But the reason why I care so much and want to go see them is because of eBird. So let me stop for this break and give this commercial on eBird. No. It's an incredible app. I was using it last week out doing a walk with Pip. On the weekends, just doing my local bird counts. It's really helping scientists. It's really helping nature and conservation. Again, eBird and then the Merlin Bird ID. I love it. It's Pokemon Go for birds. I'm addicted to it. And especially after Jesse bird shamed me a few months ago, I think I mentioned it. I was like, my species list.
Are you too old to be bird shamed? I mean...
He's like, how many species have you seen? I think it was around 250 at that point. He's like, oh, Chris, that's awful. He needs to do better. It's like, okay. So just alone in January, I saw 116 bird species. I went out and birded. Of course, I was in Australia for a couple weeks. So I did do some birding. And so just my bird list, like I've seen 99 species in New Zealand. I'm one away from 100. So I got to get to the South Island. That's where a lot of my species I haven't seen yet. I've seen 81 species in Australia, 11 species in Vanuatu, 10 species in New Caledonia, 109 species in the U.S. So the next time every time I go to the U.S., I do some birding. I've seen 30 in Canada and 28 in Fiji. So that's my world bird list of 308 species I've seen so far.
Wow. Well, you can definitely bird shame me because I'm just now downloading eBird.
I we've been doing this for 7 years.
Now, listen, I will tell you, I always get these cheap smartphones and never have enough data. So I think I had it before and I had some stuff started on it. And then I had to, you know, quick offload some apps to like save the memory. So anyways, we're going to start over now. And
it's so much fun.
It's 2024. We'll see how I do at the end of the year. And
you'll probably be at like 500.
Which one do you keep your count on? Do you keep it on the eBird or on the
eBird app? So you have to sign up with an email. Then you log in, has your stats, keeps all your checklists. So you go out, you start your checklist. You use the Merlin ID to identify birds. I'll tell you what's great in the U.S. is now I use Sound ID quite a lot because in the U.S. they've documented a lot of the sound. So you just click that, it records, and it pops up and tell you what birds are around you. And you can watch it as it records. And as the bird makes the sound, it like identifies it for you. It's awesome. The photo ID, I haven't found to be as good with Merlin yet. But then just the sizes, identify this bird, and then you look at it, and you look at all the birds in your area. Because it's all regional, so you need to download regional maps. It's incredible. And Cornell is using all this information to help birds, you know, and bird researchers around the world. And we're getting ideas of where birds are migrating due to climate change. We are getting ideas on bird counts. You know, when we talk about billions of biomass lost, that's not species, but that's saying we went from 500,000 elephants to now 100,000 elephants. We've lost 400,000 animals, right? So we've lost billions of individual birds across, you know, couple thousand species in the Americas. And one of those that I wanted to talk about was that great auk, as I opened up with.
Mm-hmm.
Because this was the original penguin. That's what's so funny. They knew about great auks before they knew about penguins in the Southern Hemisphere, the Europeans that were the scientists that started all this off. And the great auk was a large black and white flightless bird in the Atlantic Ocean. It stood about 33 inches tall, so twice the size of the puffin, weighed about 11 pounds, so it was pretty big. And again, it was flightless, so the puffins can fly, and they fly pretty quick. This was a black and white large bird, and gorgeous. It was just gorgeous. And the genus for the great auk is Pinguinus. So this is where we get the word penguin.
Oh, interesting.
Now, the great auk was from North America, so down near Florida, ranged all the way up into Greenland, Iceland, and Europe. So it's just like the range of the Atlantic puffin. But they were really prized for their meat and their eggs and their fat. And so they were hunted, and they were overhunted. And by the 1770s, they were threatened. I mean, they were being hunted for their feathers to make, you know, pillows. And it made me think of the dodo, because the dodo went extinct in the 1680s. This was a flightless bird on Mauritius, which is on one island. The great auk was in the millions. There was millions of them. But as seafaring Europeans were out on the Atlantic Ocean, they kept hunting them and hunting them and hunting them, that they became really rare. And then they became so rare by the 1800s, museums were paying top dollar for specimens.
Wow.
And so people were out specifically looking for them to hunt them so they could be mounted. Now, the last breeding pair, and this story always breaks my heart, was on July 3rd in 1844, some fishermen from Iceland went and confirmed there was a pair of great auks on Eldli Island off Iceland, and they were nesting, and they went and killed the last two birds and then crushed the egg on land. They didn't collect the egg, they just crushed it. And I've read that story years ago, and it just always stuck with me about how humans, especially, you know, then didn't realize the impact they were having on the species, and they were extinct. And so it harkens to what's going on today, why Angie and I do this podcast. I always tell the story of the great auk when I talk about conservation and why we need to learn about the history of where animals have been. And thankfully, in the 1900s, things turned around. Like, we knew the bison. Now the bison's a great story. They were down to 600. And because of zoos and the Smithsonian, now there's over 20, close to 30,000 of them out in the wild. So it just, the great auk, we can't let the puffins go the way of the great auk. You know, with, and then I just saw a story, and I want to talk about albatross again at some point. Maybe we just grab a single species and cover them in the near future, because here in New Zealand, there's a lot of long line fishing,
right?
Which looks like their prey. And so an albatross goes and they get hooked on a line and they drown and die. And so now there's debate in our government and our fisheries on how to protect the albatross, because some of these albatross species are critically endangered and they're beautiful. Oh my goodness, they're beautiful birds. So anyways, I get off my soapbox, but I know you listening care about these animals. That's why you're listening. But we need to tell these stories. We need to tell the great auk story, the dodo story, all these species that did go extinct. And then we need to tell the good stories, like the bison, like the California condor, black-footed ferret, Przewalski's horse, Przewalski's horse, all of these great conservation success stories, because conservation does work. We know that. And we just need to apply it to all these species.
Absolutely, Chris. Just really quick, what's your username so I can follow you on the bird?
Oh, geez. Can you follow me? I think it's CJ Martinson. I can.
Oh, but maybe that's why. Okay. Okay. No, that was not. I'm just teasing. I mean, I will follow you. But no, Chris, it was really well said. And I agree.
Yeah. If anybody wants to see my bird stats, you can follow me on eBird, CJ Martinson, and you can look at my little paltry list. 308 species.
That's better than me. You have 308 more than me. So,
yeah.
Wow. But we're going to be friends on eBird, and I'm excited to help, like you said, for the data. I guess I didn't realize too that like the data was being collected, and that's so important for citizen science. And
It's huge. It's huge. Yeah. It's huge. It's massive.
Well, it'll be fun. It'll be fun for my kids to get into it. And I mean, I see birds all the time, so I don't know if I've seen 308, but I feel like I've seen a lot. So it gamifies a little bit more, makes it a little bit more of a challenge. And like you said too, now with the ability to listen to all the different calls, because that's always a fun thing, behaviorally speaking, to get into. So no, I think I'm ready. I think I am ready to join the birding fun. Just please tell Jesse not to bird shame me, because then I'll get scared and I'll like run away and I won't
do it. No, Pip loves it. She's a good bird spotter. And like I said, you go out and you start hearing learning the calls, and we're like, oh, that's a great Garragon. Tui's easy. Oh, fantail over here in the bushes. Oh, those are the sparrows. Those are, you know, you start identifying the morpork, which is our owl, because it sounds like mopo.
Oh, like, yeah.
It's hooting. Yeah, it's hilarious. So anyways, I can't recommend it enough. Good spot to take a quick break. Fun stuff coming. Especially their beaks. Did you know their beaks glow in the dark? What is going on with that?
Yeah. You sent me that article and it kept me up at night.
Yeah. So very fun stuff coming your way. Just stay tuned. We'll be right back.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan. But nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast. And my name is Brenna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore all of the weird little questions and conspiracies of the universe in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything. Everything has an explanation.
We hope.
But that is what we're here to figure out. We will dive into the science behind many popular conspiracy theories, such as vaccines causing autism, flat earth theory, and was the moon landing fake? And if so, why the heck would anyone even do that?
But it's not just conspiracies. There's a lot of cool mysteries that we will attempt to use science to explain, such as near-death experiences, what made the Vikings go berserk, and can I control my co-host with MK Ultra?
Wait, what? Anyway, make sure to check out the Mystery of Everything podcast everywhere where you find your podcasts.
Welcome back. All right, evolution. I mean, birds, we've done this. You have thousands and thousands of species of bird. Angie, there's over 300 species. I guarantee you in the Southeast United States, you'll be able to surpass me pretty quick.
I think so. Yeah. I see a lot of birds on the daily in Florida. Especially.
Yeah, there's a ton
and
there.
I walk 3 miles a day or run, so I'm always out in nature doing stuff.
Yeah, I remember. I mean, the thing is, like, especially the rare ones, because I know Pip was like, I want to see a bald eagle. And so we were in California, fat chance. You have to really go in the mountains. Then we were in Idaho because see my late father who passed away last year before he passed away. And my aunt and uncle said, oh, there's bald eagles all around. Go look for them. Never did. And then when I went to Canada for work and I looked on my eBird app and I was like, oh, we were near Niagara Falls and the city. And as we were driving, I'm like, that is a bald eagle nest way in the distance. Mm-hmm. And I pulled over, got out the bins, and there was a bald eagle right next to the nest. And Pip was super happy, and I got to add it to my list. You know, I've seen him in Florida. Yeah,
I was going to say, they're at my horse farm that's breeding season right now. We're watching the waiting for the juvenile or the chicks to then turn into juvenile so we can see them fledge. So, yeah, I'm pretty spoiled when it comes to that. But I will not click. I won't click it on the button until I see it this weekend.
Thank you. Go see it. And when you log it, you send me the proof. I will dance up and down for you. Okay. So with the birds, puffin, interesting, same order as Arctic terns. So the Caradira forms. So these are medium to large sized birds, about 390 species, a lot of pelagic birds. The family, which I found very interesting, is just known as the ox, which is funny. So they are Alcidae, but they're known as the ox. There's 23 species in the family. And a lot of them are obviously the three puffin species, but then you get auklets, because remember, the great ox extinct. And then you get murrelets and gullimets, and there is the little auk, which is still around, and then some murres. So I'm sure razorbill, God, that would be a fun one to see too. So a bunch of fun birds in that species. Now getting into the genus, Fratercula, three species, the three auk species I've talked about, the Atlantic puffin, the horned puffin, and the tufted puffin. All just beautiful, beautiful birds. We know birds are ancient. Actually, I just came across, I put this in my slide set, that new data indicates birds evolved earlier than we thought.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah, 160, 180 million years ago, birds were evolving, but they thought really the fifth mass extinction is what let birds diversify, which is true, and that is somewhat true. But they're finding that even before that, during the age of dinosaurs, birds were diversifying. So different families. So there's a lot of new data indicating that birds have been around a lot longer than we think. When we look at specifically auk-like birds, you know, we're talking 30, 35 million years ago, these pelagic birds were starting to evolve as the earth was changing. The modern auk species, they estimate dates around 5 million years. So these are old birds.
That's what I was coming across when I was reading about it. I'm like, that's old.
Yeah, it's an older species. I mean, these are older birds when, you know, humans were thinking 300,000 to 500,000 years ago. A lot of our mammal species, the modern versions emerging within the last million. Some of these species, like bird species are, have been around for quite a long time through warming and cooling trends. So hopefully, you know, climate change won't impact them as much, probably push them further north. It's just what we're doing to our oceans, I think, is the big thing. Overfishing, all the pollution, all of that. So been around for a long time. Gorgeous birds. And okay. When you look at lifespans, average lifespan 20 years, which is good for a medium-sized bird, not a parrot, which lives to be like 80 or 90.
Right.
But, you know, 20. And then the oldest under human care lived to be 36. So pretty good lifespan.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, one thing that surprised me is how fast these birds are. So puffins can fly upwards of 55 miles per hour or 88 kilometers an hour. Yeah, they're fast. They can beat their wings 400 beats per minute. Now, that's not hummingbird, but that's fast.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, I can't even
that's fast.
What that looks like.
Yeah, 400 beats yeah. per minute. So that's almost 7 beats a second. That's super fast. And they say it moves so fast that they're a blur. They look like a football, you know, or rugby ball as they fly. Like it's
oh,
just,
yeah, they're so like stocky and squatty. I love
yeah,
it. Love
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So they are fast. Yeah, they can fly pretty quick, but they can swim too, right? They're good swimmers.
I mean, I think that's just what makes it even more amazing is that their wings are short and they're adapted for swimming and basically what's considered a flying technique underwater. So it's just crazy. Puffins also have really amazing diving capabilities for when they're hunting fish or crustaceans or whatever's in the ocean. And so they basically swim underwater by flapping their wings. Of course, they're in the water, but they looks like they're flapping. And then they have web feet, those red, orange web feet that steer, kind of acting like a rudder, if you will. And they have really, they can make really agile turns as they're chasing after prey or targeting some kind of prey. And then it's just mind blowing. I had no idea, but puffins can dive as deep as 60 meters or 200 feet when they're searching for food.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And they do
crazy.
This all by using their wings that are really good at flying, but and also their web feet, which is just. I don't know. I feel like it's like one or the other, right? We think of really good swimmers and divers as penguins, but penguins then obviously lost the ability to fly. So, I mean, I just was very impressed with their diving and swimming skills and the way that they can just navigate underwater as well as they can navigate in the air when we get to their migration, which is just incredible. So, I mean, I don't know. They may win the superior, like, I don't know if they can ride a bike, but I think that they might be the triathlete of the birds. I mean, you know, seriously.
Well, like, let me throw a wrench into that. Have you ever seen them take off or land in water?
Well, I mean, nobody cares how the exchange goes. You just got to get it done, right?
I know. Well, they said that's why they're the clowns of the sea, because they are so gangly and they are not that athletic, I guess, when they land in water or when they take off from water. So they look pretty pretty funny when they do that. But
from an evolutionary point of view, you have to not be good at something, right? Like you can't be good at everything, for goodness sakes. So and then not only did they adapt to have these wings to fly super fast and at good speeds in the air, but then also fly underwater and dive down deep. But their feathers, they have a really cool wax coating on their feathers that basically helps repel water, which when you live life out at sea, and then, of course, when you're diving, making the feathers waterproof-like, if you will, is very important.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they say, just to finish off, so when they do take off, and I've even seen, like albatross take off. They're not that graceful
either. Now I have
to
find that YouTube video. I did not see that.
So, you know, they belly flop or they flip over when they land in water. And then when they take off, it's like they're running. Mm-hmm. I've even seen swans take off before. That is funny. That
yeah,
is like
that. I've definitely seen that. It's hilarious, but
that takes like they need the longest runway on Earth to get up at the ground.
Yes, but
that's not why they get their clowns of the sea. It's because the beak.
Right, the beak. Oh my gosh, how many slides do I have on the beak?
Okay, Let's go. Okay, the beak.
It really is one of their unique identifiers, right? It really sets them apart visually compared to a lot of other seabirds as far as their markings go. So the beak of the puffin, the puffins are large and they're colorful depending on the species. Typically red, orange, but they can kind of be a combination of yellow, red, and orange. They have a little bit of black or gray at the base of it a little bit. And then the other really incredible thing is when puffins are in breeding season, and we'll talk more about that when we get to reproduction, but the beak of the Atlantic puffin, for example, is dull. It still has color, mind you. It's not like it's like black and white. It still has color, but it's very dull. And then during during breeding season, it becomes very vibrant, very bright in color, like to help attract females. And so that part is, we see that in a little bit in other species, but the puffin, it really stuck out. And that beak is when it's something. It's very, very, very bright. And then, of course, the male's beak does get even brighter than the female's. And it's used as a successful identifier as a healthy, fit male for the females. And so just really, I was just, of course, always fascinated by that physiology. And so, and I know you were actually the one sending a lot of the cool puffin beak stuff. And so,
well, yeah. So they, it does under UV light, it glows, and the scientists don't know why. It could be because they can probably see it better.
Their vision or something.
You know, yeah. With their vision. It kind of goes back to some of these superpowers we always talk about in these animals. I don't know why the mantis shrimp came to my head. If you've not listened to that episode, you've got to go back and listen to Mantis Shrimp. Wherever you are in the world.
You need this in your life.
Oh, they're the most incredible. They see in like 16 different spectrums of light. Like, oh, they're insane. So Mantis Shrimp would be able to see them. So I they don't quite know, but they're like, okay, why now are their beaks lighting up? And so scientists are discovering this. A couple things about their beaks, which are really interesting. I'll talk about why it changes color, but also it's got kind of like a hinge at the base of the beak.
Mm-hmm.
So it opens up really wide, more than your typical bird beak. And that's important for them to be able to catch as many fish when they dive and swim so they can catch more fish. So it opens up and then closes. The record, could you guess how many fish? I don't know if you found this fact. Did you see
a lot more? I did. So
yeah.
So the beak can hold a lot of these little fish that they like to catch, which makes sense when they're needing to breed, you know, to bring it back to the nest for their partner or for their chicks. And I think the record of a little fish called a sand eel was 83 in the bill of a puffin. 83 little fishies. In the bill of the puffin at one time. And and besides having a big bill and being able to open it wide, as Chris mentioned, they also, it's like a little serrated as well, where the top and bottom, the mandible and maxilla, like meat basically of the bill. And so I think that serrated nature of it helps to hold the fish in place. And 83 fish in place.
Yeah, that's pretty great. Yeah.
That's a superpower. My goodness gracious.
They're hungry. They're hungry.
Yeah.
They gotta eat because, you know, they're getting ready for breeding season.
Mm-hmm.
And this change in the bill. So what I found, and I know we talked about before we recorded that you're talking about hormones. There's probably some of that, but also and we've talked about this in other species. I know we have, because we've been doing this for going on 7 years now, but the carotenoid coloration.
Yes.
So the pigmentation that gives us the yellows, the oranges, the reds, you see this all across bird species in their plumage. And we see this in the puffin in their bills.
Mm-hmm.
Now, cannot be synthesized or made by the body. They have to get it from their diet. So there is some sort of internal metabolic process that in their diet, they're able to trigger this production of these pigments that are in their bills. The reason they evolved to do this is that there's a couple hypotheses. One is the foraging hypothesis. So researchers think that it's directly linked to an individual's ability to forage. So the puffins that can catch more carotenoid-rich prey, they can produce more pigmented traits. So the more fish they catch, sand eels and others, they're able to produce more carotenoid. Their beaks are brighter. And if you're looking for a mate, you're like, ooh, he's got a bright, colorful beak. I want to mate with him. You know, he's healthy. And I don't mean to say just the males, because the females too, they their beaks also change. So we know a lot with birds, it's the male putting on the show, but with puffins, both the male and female's beaks change.
Yeah. And then what's interesting, they have these bright red beaks. And then I think also their feet get more red, orange in color as well to help attract the mates. But then after breeding season, when it's time for them to migrate across the ocean, their beaks then lose color. And one paper described it almost as like, almost like a shedding of the plate, the outer layer of beak, the beak plate would come off, and then below it would be a duller color of the beak. So really,
it is, and
it must be. I mean, I'm totally just hypothesizing here, but somewhat controlled by hormones or something, or
seasonal variation. That drives it. Yeah, we know that with the change of warming and longer days, that definitely triggers hormones. And then diet, too. So the puffins are eating, they just do plankton, but mainly fish. Like I said, all the tiny fish in the sea, the sand eels, the caprins and things. And that provides the vitamin A, the carotenoids, you thought some maybe fatty acids or whatever that helps drive this production of pigmentation. So while they're out there in the spring, you know, they're out there foraging a lot because that's when life is emerging. Then they come in, and we'll talk about reproduction here in a minute, and you can talk about their migration routes because they spend a lot of time at sea, but then they do come in for a few months and raise their chicks, right?
Well, yeah, Chris, just add a few fun nutrition facts about puffins is that I found it super curious when they are migrating and spending a lot of time out at sea, and I promise we'll get there and talk about that in more detail, but they don't have the ability to drink fresh water, so they actually will drink salt water and are able to utilize it to some degree to help them travel these long distances across the ocean, whether it's the Atlantic or the Pacific. And when they're flying for day after day after day, migrating, or probably even when they're trying to feed their young, puffins will feed about 40 times a day. So they're doing these incredible, let's assume they're fishing in the ocean, these incredible high altitude diving techniques where they're able to, from a high distance or over, and then get into the water and go down deep, very deep, as we talked about earlier, to make their catches. And they'll pull up 5, 10, 8, maybe not 83 fish at once, but a lot of fish. But because of their high energy demands when they are either migrating or during breeding season, they have to feed a lot. And so, I mean, they're just a really fantastic bird. It's just so fascinating. I would love to see them. And then all these fish that they're catching and they're holding in their bill, it's not like they're swallowing the prey and then regurgitating it like we see in some species of birds. The with the serrated bill of the puffin, it's they hold the fish cross length in there, so they all stick out. It was basically what I'm saying. When you look at pictures of them, they have all fish heads, fish tails, 10 of them all lined up and their bills sticking out. So it's definitely a sight to behold.
Oh, they're incredible. They're so fun. They're so fun.
They are. They are. Yeah. Yeah. And well, and the other, and you mentioned the ox or whatever, but it's interesting. The puffin actually flies pretty high above the water when they're hunting. Mm-hmm. They're usually about 10 meters or about 33 feet above, whereas other birds fly much lower, like 5, 10 feet.
Soaring, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right up the waves, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So they're really they're amazing flyers, as we mentioned, with the how fast their wings beat and stuff. And so when we look at the puffin as just a crazy migrating bird, like just an amazing migrator. And Chris and I have covered a couple migrators, I think this year on the podcast, because from the monarch butterfly.
Arctic tern.
Yeah. So it's just so fascinating, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, my goodness gracious. But let's take the Atlantic puffin, for example, because they are threatened and we do want to talk a little bit more about them. But man, their annual migration from their breeding grounds across the Atlantic to hang out for a little bit and then come back to get to their breeding grounds. So 1 year back and forth over the pond is close to 14,000 kilometers during their annual migration. So it's just fascinating. And it's not like they're migrating over land. This is over the ocean with the weather and the currents and the hardships, and then of course having to hunt. And the puffins typically only fly during the day. So they fly and they're flying and they hunt during the day because they can see. So they're doing both of those things out on the open ocean. And then at nighttime, they're usually landing in the water to rest and sleep and repeat. Mm-hmm. So it's just incredible. And of course, the migration patterns are going to look a little bit different among puffin species, obviously, because of where they live. But even among the Atlantic puffin, males and females have a little bit different migration patterns. Females will often travel farther than males, and head to further inland wintering grounds. And so, for example, the Atlantic puffins are coming over from Europe, and then they winter across the pond in North America. Not Florida typically, but spending a lot of time in Canada or Massachusetts, Maine, that kind of area. They hang out there, which that doesn't really seem like where I'd want to winter. I would probably want to winter more in Florida, but they'll hang out there. And then when it is time for them to return to their spring breeding grounds, their return migration is actually super rapid. Mm-hmm. So there's been estimates demonstrating the individual puffins will travel thousands of kilometers back to their breeding colonies in about a week. So I'm not sure if they're riding currents or not stopping to eat as much and lollygag, but it's a much faster return migration than it is coming out to North America. So just when you look at it on a map and some of these patterns, it's just breathtaking that this little bird with these wings beating so fast and being able to dive and catch fish does that year after year. And all to just, I guess, follow the fish and get the food that they need to be able to survive. And then, of course, to come back to their breeding colonies over in Europe. This is the Atlantic puffin. To come back to Iceland or UK or wherever to breed. It's just, so fascinating.
No, I know. It's like that. This is why you love birds. They're insane. Right? Yeah,
They are superheroes. Yeah. I'm sorry.
They fly all over the world. They know where they're going. They've got that internal compass, and they do. I know we've talked about this. How they do it. How the Arctic tern gets from pole to pole. The Amur falcon migrating from the middle of Mongolia all the way down to Africa. Now you got puffins across the oceans.
There's not even landmarks in the oceans. I mean, maybe an island here or there, but they have to be using like the stars or the sun magnetism, because it's one thing for the land migrations, like we talked about in the monarch butterflies, that they probably are maybe using some instinctually known landscapes or something. Of course, they have to be using like magnetic markers in the sun as well. But here's the deal: we don't fully know at all.
Yeah, we don't know
either.
Yet. Yep, not yet.
Which is kind of cool, right? Like they're just doing this. Like I don't know about you, Chris, with the smartphones and Apple Maps, and I mean, I would get lost like going to the grocery store in this day and age because I'm so dependent on all these tools. Yeah. And like my phone, I was going somewhere the other night to meet John at this dinner thing for work. And he sent me the address and I put it in. I was like, oh, yeah, I kind of know where that's at.
Yeah.
And then my phone started dying. And I was like,
got scared.
Yeah. Like if this phone dies en route to this place that I'd never been to before, I have an idea of where it's at. Yeah. We're done. Like I will have to stop at a gas station and ask for directions home. Like. Because I'm so dependent on my smartphone. And it's really sad that it's embarrassing, like saying this out loud. But I mean, these birds are just, the Atlantic Ocean, that's rough, man.
I know. They are. They're amazing. So, I mean, yeah. What other cool behaviors you come across?
Yeah. So the puffin's not a super vocal bird, except for when it's at its breeding colony. So silent at sea. Very chatty when they are in breeding season and taking care of their chicks. The call that they make was described as simple, more of like a growling sound, usually made when they're around their burrow or nest. Let's see. And I think as far as signals to communicate, of course, they have some pheromones and body language, but of course, and tactile, of course. We'll talk about that when we get to their courtship rituals. But I think the biggest communication that they probably have, especially centered around breeding, is going to be the color, especially for males, right? Like, hey, I'm healthy. I'm fit. I have a good immune system. I have a good diet. I have good genetics. So, it's going to brighter males are going to attract more females. And I thought it was really fascinating. I found an article in 2019, so pretty recent. Where animal researchers observed puffins in two separate geographic locations using sticks to scratch themselves, which suggests that these birds have the ability to use basic tools, which is also a measure of more advanced cognition and intelligence in several species. That's long been one of the markers for advanced cognition and intelligence is the ability to use tools. So they need more research on that of like I was telling John about it. He's so cute. He's like, well, like, how were they using it? And like, he wanted more details. I'm like, I don't know. I wasn't there. But I think they were using the bill and, you know, the bill to use it. And they must have, you know, thought it seemed like a tool. And so of course, there needs to be more exploration. Like, do they pass this down to other generations? And does it happen all the time? And would they use another tool if they had it? So, but that's science, right? You observe something and then you have more questions about it and then you do more studies. So I look forward to learning more about that. But my goodness gracious, after studying in this past week and learning about how they migrate and what they do to stay alive and how they're amazing flyers and amazing swimmers, I mean, they seem pretty smart. I feel like using a tool would not be beyond them. That's for sure. So
well, I mean, we see crows using tools to pick food out of stuff, right? Stones and beakers, yeah.
Well, and that's and parrots as well, right? And so I think those have always been the comparison, right? The standard, like, oh, parrots do it, crows do it. So I think it took researchers back a little bit, like puffins do it? Like we thought they were clowns. So that's the cool thing about science is we're still learning. And I don't think we've tested all the animals to learn how smart they are. I think in years to come, we're just going to learn that animals are probably way more brilliant than us.
Yes. Okay. Now, here's a learning moment for everybody that's still with us. E-bird, you said sounds. So one of the things I like to do sometimes when I'm out looking for birds is I'll play the sound off Merlin Bird ID and call the birds down to me. And they'll come down and dance around your head like, where's this sound coming from? So I did pull up the Atlantic Puffin. So let's see what this, so I've got their calls and I've got the bill rattle that you just talked about. So let's see what this sounds like. So that's one of their calls. Here's another
one. I love it. It kind of sounds like an old man laughing.
This is like a dirt bike. All right. Okay. And then here's that bill rattle. I love this. Is why I love this app. It is so fun. I'll tell you what, I've used this app a lot. That is some of the most unique calls I've heard out of all the birds. Yeah, that's really unique. Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah,
so I did. If people know how to do that, in Merlin Bird ID, you can go and they have bird packs for certain areas of the earth. That was the Atlantic one. Downloaded it and then just found the Atlantic Puffin. And then on there's the sounds and you click and you can hear them. So what you do is wherever you live in the world, you get used to the bird calls by listening to it and spotting them. And then when you're out in the wild, you're like, oh yeah, that's a puffin. If I heard that now,
you would know it. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, there's not gonna be puffins in New Zealand, but you know, I know our local birds, but yeah, really cool stuff, Angie.
Oh, so fun. Oh my goodness. And so, yeah, these birds are brilliant and they're so incredible and unique and gosh, the superpowers. I mean, my goodness, their bill glows under UV light and researchers don't know why. So we're still learning a lot of fun things. But what we do know about puffins in general, all the different species, is that when it comes to breeding, they do form long-term relationships. So they're monogamous, especially the Atlantic puffin. We know that is a monogamous species, which means they typically keep the same partner for a lifetime. And when they do breed, when it is breeding season, the puffins will tend to breed in these large colonies on coasts and islands, and they typically gather in the late spring. That's when they breed, which that makes sense. The weather's getting warmer. And their courtship is darling. So they'll make a lot of these calls, like Chris was just playing. And along with these breeding calls, the puffin will do this movement called billing. And so billing will occur when two puffins show interest in each other, whether they're a new couple forming or an old monogamous pair reuniting their flame. But the two puffins will touch their beaks together. They'll go back and forth like they're nodding their head. And you only see this billing, this little bill dance back and forth in pairs that are going to mate, that either have mated in the past or planning to mate. So it's a very serious, you're going steady. You just don't bill everybody. Okay. It means business, right? So it's like putting a ring on it basically. Right.
Yep. Yep.
So, what I think is really fascinating is that when they look at these partnerships, and I think this is why we probably either need more GPS collaring or just more research. Researchers don't really know whether or not a puffin will find its mate before the journey across the Atlantic to go to the breeding colony or once they get on the breeding colony. So it's really interesting. So we don't really know if they hang out in the off season. Like they definitely hang out during breeding season and they're very good parents. And we'll talk about that. But does it just all fall apart once they cross the Atlantic or not? Do they hang out or do they find each other in, you know, a cute little Bar Harbor, Maine beach town and then say, okay, let's fly back together. It's just fascinating to me. And then it also it baffles them how they find their same mate every year, year after year after year. Oh, my husband's looking at me. Oh, my husband says it's not Bar Harbor. It's Bahaba. Okay. That's how you pronounce it. I apologize to all my New England fans. Jonathan, thank you for the corrections. Not Bar Harbor.
It's Bar.
Come on, hold on. We're not gonna. He can't do a puffin call, and you guys can't see us do a puffin billing dance. But he can tell us how to pronounce that city.
Bar Harbor.
Oh, Mr. Boston.
Honey, I love you. We'll bill later, okay? We'll do a billing dance later.
All right. Let's keep it peachy.
Wicked awesome up there.
it's wicked awesome up there. But they don't know. Like, are the puffins having this conversation and then heading across the Atlantic together, or are they meeting up in Iceland or wherever their breeding colony is, and then picking up from there? Researchers don't know. So anybody listening, you could be the one that wins the prize, the Nobel Puffin Prize on eBird for answering that, right? We don't know. But what we do know is once male and female bill and they find each other, they need to build a nest. Different species of puffins build their nests differently. And so I'll focus a little bit more on the Atlantic puffin, since that's the vulnerable bird that we've been talking more about today. But when it comes to Atlantic puffins, the male Atlantic puffin is a real good worker. He definitely builds a strong nest and wants to be a part of it. He'll put the female to work a little bit. She'll help kind of dig out the burrow in the area and find a suitable place. But he's definitely all in. And so puffins in general will typically use like large rocky areas that have protection from the gnarly elements where they're breeding, like in Iceland. And it'll usually help protect them from predators as well. And the Atlantic puffin kind of goes a little bit of a step further and builds even more of like a burrow nest, if you will. And so the puffins, both the male and the female, will use their big bill to help shovel out and move sand or dirt or rocks to help build this little burrow and form a nest that is decent size. And they'll use grass and feathers and other things to help build it up and make it nice and comfortable for the egg that the female will lay. And so once male and female puffin build this lovely nest, the female will lay a single egg. And then both parents, male and female, will incubate the egg until it hatches. Atlantic puffin eggs are typically creamy white, but some of them have like a lilac shade to them, which is light purple, beautiful, right? Mm-hmm. And the parents, when they are incubating, warming the egg, they'll basically hold the egg against their brood patch with their wings. And they take turns doing this very lovingly. For on average about 40 days, anywhere from 39 to 45 days. And then the egg will crack and a baby chick puffin is called a puffling.
Puffling?
That's puffling. Yeah. That's like my favorite fact. I love it. So the puffling is super cute. They're black and fluffy. Their eyes, different than other chicks, their eyes can open immediately. As soon as they hatch, and they're tiny, they're about 42 and a half grams. And then after the puffling is born, the male puffin will continue to protect the burrow from predators. And then they'll take turns going out. Male and female do both go out and catch food for themselves, but then also for the puffling. And they hang out like this for a while, usually anywhere from 1.5 to almost 3 months, 38 to 50 days. Before the puffling is ready to fledge and becomes independent. Pufflings typically fledge at night, probably to ward off predators. After a puffing fledges, the chicks spend the first couple years of their lives at sea. So that's pretty hardcore, right? Like,
yeah, I know.
I mean, you get kicked out of your home and it's like off to sea you go. So it's just crazy. And then they know their internal clock and instinct to return to their breeding season about 5 years later. So,
oh, so cute. They're so adorable. Yeah.
So, but think about that. When you think of other bird species, I mean, the Atlantic puffins don't reach sexual maturity until they're about 5 years old. The range is 3 to 6, but on average five, they're just hanging out at sea, trying to figure it out, hopefully surviving, learning how to you know, fly and be awesome, and then dive and be awesome and carry all those little sand eels in their bill. And then voila, they know, okay, I'm five. It's time to go find a mate and hopefully I'm successful at it. So birds are just really cool and a lot smarter and have a lot more superpowers than we even know about. Honestly. I know.
Oh, they're beautiful. Oh, you're saying that a monarch butterfly just flew by my window. One of the New Zealand ones. I see them everywhere now after our podcast on monarchs. If you haven't heard that one, that one's incredible.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about maybe living as long as up to 20, because we know that's, you know, that's not the average. That's the as long as they can live in the wild. And there are so many. See the monarch's back. Hi, monarch. I love them. It is concerning. So, you know, right now, I'm going to give you this number. It sounds huge. Over 8 million puffins, they believe, Atlantic puffins left, but they are vulnerable. In Europe, the population has decreased close to 70% in the past 50 years. So the biomass of puffins has gone way down. And it's reflective of probably some overfishing in the oceans, but also they are talking about climate change because climate change is changing Gulf streams. We've covered that. Go back to African penguins, how that is that dire situation there where the Gulf Stream off South Africa has been pushed, what, another 30, 40 kilometers further south. So penguins are, they're going to forage and generally it was like 20 or 30 kilometers. This is going off a few years ago, memory, but I remember Stephanie Arney telling the story how they would go 20 kilometers offshore, forage, come back to their chicks. Now they're going 50, 60, 70 kilometers offshore and the chicks die. So climate change is a big problem for birds and that's going to impact puffins and albatross and all these other pelagic ocean going species. So that's why we got to fight for them. And what organization? There's so many good ones for birds, but which one out there did you want to support today for puffins?
Okay, Chris, today I want to highlight a group called Puffin Preservation. And so Puffin Preservation can be found at puffinpreservation.org. And their mission is quite simply what we all want. Puffin Preservation wants to protect and preserve and spread awareness about the plight of the puffin. So good people, right? And they do a lot of different things to help get that done. Just to list a few things that this awesome group has done, Puffin Preservation has monitored over 800 puffin burrows for breeding success twice a year for the last 4 years. They've banded over 3,000 puffin chicks. This is cool. This is what I'm talking about. This is how we learn more. They've given lots of lectures about puffin conservation in multiple different countries. They speak with tourists about the plight of the puffin. They have successfully cleaned, rehabilitated, and released injured or harmed chicks, over 500 puffin chicks to be precise. And they also train volunteers and help educate people and do a lot of interviews on how to help puffin survive in the wild and how not to overhunt them or overeat them and things like that. So really cool group. They're also on Instagram. So check out puffinpreservation.org and give them a like and a follow on Instagram. I just checked out their account. Beautiful photos. Just you'll see what Chris and I are talking about. Yeah.
I would love that job. I mean, I love what we do and I love what I do, but just protect puffins. Like, okay, I go out and I band puffins and I just love them. I love them. A fun species. So much fun.
Yeah. This is why we do what we do. And I mean, we're talking about the website's really nice, this Puffin Preservation. But these are just, I mean, people that are just helping out. And somebody had a love of puffins and every chick helps, right? Like every educational talk that they give, every person they get excited about puffins. It's just, I mean, of course, Chris and I, with our platform, we have the ability to, and we have talked to incredible conservationists from the World Wildlife Fund and really big groups, National Geographic, things like that. There's a lot of people just like us that maybe don't have a bigger name or something like that, or bigger affiliation, that are still on the ground doing the work, and they're a hero. Puffin Preservation volunteers and workers are heroes. You listening to this podcast and sharing it with your friend, getting people excited about puffins and carotenoids in their beak and all sorts of, calling them pufflings. Show your friend a picture of a puffling. If you love your friends, you will send them a picture of a puffling and show them and spread the love. And that's how we can all help be conservation heroes.
Yeah, absolutely. And with that, stay tuned for another podcast next week.
Listen, learn, share. Join the movement at allcreaturespod.com.